When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain and he sat down. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and he taught them. It's the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. This is our last sermon about the Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to miss that. For some reason, it's not so much that I like sitting, I just like the bench. I like the idea of it. Well, I like the idea of doing it the way Jesus did it, which is kind of interesting. So we've spent 4 weeks, we will have spent at the end of today, 4 weeks on the Sermon on the Mount. In William Barclay's New Testament commentary, which is a series of volumes, most of which are one book in the Bible, with the letters, which are shorter, sometimes one volume will have several of Paul's letters in it. He has two volumes on John, and he has two volumes on Matthew. And within the two volumes on Matthew, chapters 5, 6, and 7, which would be the Sermon on the Mount, take up 200 and something pages. And it is just that rich. I mean, it's a wonderful reservoir of Jesus' teachings. Now, probably, well, I should say more than probably, really certainly, Jesus didn't speak all of these as, he didn't give it as a sermon. We call it the Sermon on the Mount, but he didn't give all that as a sermon. Those are pieces of other sermons that he would have given over a length of time, and Matthew has chosen to put them all together. He's edited, of course, and he's put all of that together. So we're dealing here today with everything from Jesus' talk about prayer in the sixth chapter through the end. We didn't read, we read only a part of that. And most of what I'm going to talk about is covered by what we read a little bit that's outside of that. So the passage that we read begins with, judge not, don't judge others. Some years back, actually a lot of years back, when I was in Providence and Matthewson Street, probably 40 years ago, maybe a little less, I was called to jury duty. At the courthouse in Providence. So I'm going to tell the story out of order. The first part is just because it amuses me to tell it, so I'm going to tell you. So what happened is this. Eventually, I was placed on a jury. So the trial started at, I think, 10 o'clock in the morning. That's okay. So went through the day, and they had a short day. It got done, and we left, and the bailiff or whoever it was that was talking to us said, make sure you're back here at 9 a.m. sharp. Okay. So the next day, I got there at 9:05. I was at Matthewson Street, so I parked over at the church, did some work, then walked, less than half a mile. It's not very far. Walked across the city. I got to the courthouse, again, as I said, at 9:05. Of course, nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. We just sat there. And then, a little after 10, we were called in, and the trial began. And when they finished that day, the bailiff, or whoever it was, said to the jury, be back tomorrow, 9 a.m. sharp. So I asked somebody, so is the trial starting at 9 tomorrow? No, it's starting at 10. Okay. So the next day, I went to work, and last. There are plenty of time. I mean, nothing could. How could I be late? I could only be late if I fell in a manhole, you know? Oh my goodness. You would think the world had ended. I mean, it was like they were ready to send out a search party for me. Why was I not there at 9 o'clock? I'm like, well, I don't know. Did you start at 9? No, it. Anyway, the story has always amused me. But you'll be pleased to know the next day I did get there like a good boy at 9 in the morning and sat politely. But that's not the point. The point is this. When we were being questioned by the prosecutor and the defense attorney, because of course they question prospective jurors, and they disqualify some people. So the prosecutor asked me, he said, "You're a minister." "Yes, I am." He said, "Do you think you can judge another human being?" And, you know, of course, what do you want? They want yes or no answers. What do you say to that? And I think I tried to answer in a more nuanced way, and I think I got interrupted, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, point is, he disqualified me. He didn't want me there because he did not think I would render a judgment. You know, I was trying to explain deciding what the facts are, and deciding about facts is not the same as a judgment on someone's soul. Whatever. Here's the point of the story, though. I think that the cultural perspective of Christianity has shifted over those 40 years. And I don't think any prosecutor would be worried that a person who claimed to be a Christian, which ought to be more than pastors, but anyway, a person who claimed to be a Christian would be insufficiently judgmental. And I think that's sad. That the perception of Christians now, today, is that they tend to be judgmental. And the perception then was that they would make a judgment. This passage has always been a favorite of mine. I've told you this story before. In fact, I tell the story every single time we use this passage. So here it comes again. But it's a good story. And it's that when I first encountered this passage, and I'm going to say it really was when I began to look at the Bible on my own, you know, apart from Sunday school, you know, to actually read it on my own. And I got to this, you know, why are you worried about the speck in somebody else's eye when there's a log in your own eye? And of course, as a young person, I said, that's the problem with my parents. This is their problem. We have found it. Jesus knows what their problem is. They are so concerned with the speck in my eye, which is tiny, that they cannot even see the log in their own eye. If only they could see it, I thought. Well, I kept that view for an extended period of time. Longer than you would expect. Longer than anybody reasonably should hold that view, you know, but I did. And so it was, I don't know, 8-10 years later, before I realized the passage was not directed to my parents, it was directed to me. Okay, I encountered that as a huge insight, which, you know, it is. It's a shift. I mean, it's kind of pathetic that I thought of it the other way first, but I think, if we're honest, lots of us, when we look at scripture verses, our first thought is how it applies to somebody else, as opposed to how it applies to. So, when I went to serve the church in Mansfield, Massachusetts, I did a sermon on this scripture. And I told the story of how I had first read it, thought it applied to my parents, and then eventually realized, no, it applies to me. Okay, and I thought, I've made the point, it's really good. Anyway, so people are walking out of church. And there was a guy there with his daughter. Now, his daughter was in her 20s. She was married, had kids. I don't think her husband was there, although he often came to church. Anyway, so she came with her dad. So she and her dad, and they're coming out. And she said, that was a great sermon, thank you very much. And her dad said, that was a great sermon, thank you very much. And then he turned to his daughter and said, I just wish your mother had been here to hear that. H. Richard Niebuhr, who was the less famous of the Niebuhr brothers, Reinhold and Richard, H. Richard Niebuhr said that one of the tasks of the church is the mutual removal of specks and logs. And then he went on to say, there are always more people willing to do the removing than there are to have their eyes examined. And isn't that the truth? Reinhold Niebuhr, sort of working off the same passage, said, Christians should always have an uneasy conscience, that the burden of being a Christian is the permanent burden of an uneasy conscience, the recognition that that you're always tending to do that, that as soon as you figure out an ethical issue, you're tempted then to judge the people on the other side of that, when you need to be always reflecting yourself on how your vision is impaired in one way or another. So this passage also contains what we call the golden rule. William Barclay called it the Everest of ethical thought, and in a way it is. I mean, it's a huge insight. Now, it was common at the time to have, as the rabbis said, I think it was Hillel, who said, whatever you would not want done to you, don't do it to somebody else. So it was expressed as a negative. Don't do to other people what you would not want done to yourself. It's restraining. So Jesus, when he turns it around, makes it active. Do for others. Do the thing for others that you would like to have done for you. Now, it's easily corrupted in the most commonly as people saying, if you treat other people well, they'll treat you well. Well, that's mostly true, and that's a good thing. But that has not at all what Jesus was saying. I mean, he had nothing to do with reciprocity. It wasn't about having people treat you well in return. It was about treating them simply the way that you would like to be treated, regardless of how they treat you. On the way out, Nikki Stanley told me that at Rocky Hill School, where she taught for a number of years, their motto is something like, treat others the way you'd like to be treated. Something like that, right? And she was having trouble with one of the kids who was treating some other of his classmates badly. And she confronted him about that. And his take on it was this. Treat others the way you'd like to be treated. So he said, if they treat me badly, they must want to be treated badly in return. She said, no, that's not what it means. But it's hard for us. Now, that wonderful insight, do to others as you'd like to have them do to you, treat others the way you'd like to be treated, I mean, that really is behind Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative. When he talks, when Kant says, always treat other human beings as ends in themselves and not as means only. That's basically what he's saying. In other words, don't use other people. Don't use other people for whatever ends. The value of the other human being always has to be recognized. John Rawls wrote a book in the 20th century. Great ethicist. Rawls wrote a book called Theory of Justice. And in it, he asserted something which I find interesting and helpful. And he called it the veil of ignorance. And the way the veil of ignorance works, it's a mind experiment. It's a thought experiment. And basically it says, imagine that you didn't know where you were in a society. Then what would you think about fairness? So, for example, if you didn't know whether you were an African or a plantation owner, what would you think about slavery? If you didn't know whether you were African American or white, what would you think about segregation? If you didn't know where you were in the society, you know, what would you think about a tax structure if you didn't know where you were? And it's wonderful in helping people. If we really do it, if we really go through that experiment, it's wonderful in helping people see that though there are distinctions, there are limits on our distinctions, you know. And in some cases, it leads to new insights because it forces us to think about treating others the way we would like to be treated, because we imagine ourselves in that other position. I say that only to say that it's remarkable how Jesus' sentence is turned into John Rawls' book, turned into a huge theory, because it's that important. A more practical example is John Wesley. On February 24th, 1791, John Wesley wrote the last letter. He was a prolific letter writer and remarkable correspondence. And I'm guessing at the end he had people write for him. I'm guessing he was not writing himself, because it's only a week later that Wesley died. And there's a flurry of letters up to the end, and then this last one. The last one, the very last letter that he wrote, was to William Wilberforce, and it was about slavery. I find that significant, that it was that much on Wesley's mind, that it was his very last public thought. So he wrote to Wilberforce, of course, encouraging him in the fight to outlaw slavery in Great Britain, which was not done until 1807. Now, if you go back in Wesley's writing in 1774, he wrote basically a small book called Thoughts on Slavery. And it was basically about why he opposed slavery all around the world in all its forms, especially in the United States, which he called the vilest form of slavery. The document, and you can get that, and you get it online, and you can download it for free. It is remarkable for the passion with which he writes. This is clearly something that Wesley cares about deeply. And it's interesting the extent to which he organizes his thought about it. He talks about where slaves come from. It is a good land, he says. And he talks about what Africa is like. Obviously, from reports, Wesley was never in Africa. But he talks about that. He talks about how slaves were captured, about the trickery and the cruelty. He talks about the civilization they left behind. He suggests that many of them were, as he calls them, Mohammedans, Muslims. And it is remarkable the extent to which he details the cruelties of the slave trade. It's not easy reading. It's not easy reading about people being branded and having parts of their limbs cut off. And I mean, it's horrible, horrible, horrible stuff. But Wesley's clearly looked at this. Now, all of that comes out of a basic understanding of how do we treat other people? We treat other people the way we would want to be treated. We wouldn't want to be slaves, therefore we ought not to have slaves, right? Fascinating to me, 1774, let that date stick in your mind, 1774. The United Methodist Church split on the issue of slavery in 1844. 70 years later, right? I got that math right. Clearly, it's not like people didn't understand. I mean, sometimes when we read about historical figures, Jefferson, Washington, and others, we say, well, you know, it was a different time, and people thought differently, and so on, you know. Okay. If you were a Methodist, you've got no excuse, right? Did you not read what Wesley said in 1774? Did you not look at that? It's not an obscure work. It got wide circulation. So for anybody who said in that period of time, we didn't know. No, you did know. You did know. Or you chose not to know. You chose not to look at it. Fascinating to me for the practicality of it, and the way in which Wesley and his passion, and the way in which this springs from such a simple idea of how we treat one another. Wesley does not, in the course of that, cite scripture. You know, I mean, one of the problems in that debate was there were slave owners were citing all kinds of scripture about owning slaves. For Wesley, no, we don't need any. We've got the basic principle, and we move on. Treat others the way you want to be treated yourself. Okay, so moving along, there's more there. I want to back up to a part that we didn't actually read, where Jesus is talking about wealth, and he's talking about how it can corrupt our view of life and of one another. In the video we made for the stewardship campaign, Leslie said one of her favorite verses in relation to that was, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And we had a discussion about where's that from, and she said Matthew, and I said Luke. Well, it's in both. I'm not sure why I'd forgotten that it was in Matthew. Matthew 6:21, by the way. But it's part of, not surprising that I would get it wrong and correct somebody else. My goodness. Okay. But fascinating the way Jesus makes it personal about how we see things. Where your heart is, where your treasure is, there will your heart be. It's not abstract, right? It's practical. That's what happens. And what does he mean by that? What he means by that is that our view of the world is influenced by our wealth and where that's invested. And of course, he's right. I mean, he's absolutely right. Those things influence. I mean, talk to a homeowner about property values, right? I mean, it's like everybody's in favor of group homes. Not in my backyard, right? And it's true of, I mean, name it, whatever it is, we are influenced by how it impacts our financial situation. Have to be, okay. Now that's not all bad, but it ought not to be the only thing there, right? That can't be everything. So our vision, says Jesus, is corrupted by that. We can't help it. We see the world differently because of our self-interest. And what Jesus is calling for is instead to see the world through the other person's eyes, to see the world through the least and the last and the lonely. Barclay called the Golden Rule the Mount Everest of Christian ethics. Well, the Sermon on the Mount is, in a way, the Mount Everest of Jesus' teachings. It is a pinnacle. But it's also a mountain in terms of understanding it and living it. At the end, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who hear these words of mine and do them." He doesn't say, and it's interesting that Jesus is, yeah, he doesn't say, "Blessed are those who hear these words of mine and believe them." And Jesus talks very little about belief. Matter of fact, until you get to John's Gospel, virtually not at all about belief. But it's always about doing. As E. Stanley Jones said, your creed is your deed. What you believe is what you do. What you do is what you believe. I mean, that's how we can see what you believe by what in fact you are doing. And Jesus says, to build on a solid foundation, you need to actually do this. You need to actually follow this. And it's hard. I think it's hard. It's hard if we take it seriously. No, it's not hard at all if we pay lip service and say, "Oh, it just means we should be nice to each other." No, it doesn't just mean we should be nice to each other. It's much deeper than that. It's much more thoroughgoing than that. I mean, it has huge implications for everything that we do in the world. And to follow that, it's like climbing a mountain. It is like climbing a mountain. The significance for me of the Sermon on the Mount is that although the mountain is high and difficult to climb, and although we sometimes fail in our attempts. Nevertheless, it lifts our vision, and if we are honest about the trying, we can improve our lives. We can improve what we do and how we live. Wesley's phrase, going on to perfection. No, we're not going to get there, but we are at least going to try. We're at least going to believe that we can do better tomorrow than we did today, that we can move on and be more faithful in how we live our lives. So, not to judge, to do for others, to put our treasure where it ought to be, and in doing those things, to build on rock, the solid foundation of doing Jesus' teachings. Let's be in a spirit of prayer. Gracious God, grant us grace not to judge our sisters and brothers. Grant us grace to do for others as we would want them to do for us. Grant us grace to use our resources for the common good. Grant us grace to build on the rock of Jesus' teaching.